Hey, everybody, and welcome to the Viewing Angles podcast. It's the only movie podcast that I've ever heard of. I don't know if you've heard of any other ones, but pretty sure there's no other ones. Right, Rob? Yeah.
We are one of only seven podcasts on the internet. I don't know what the other six are, but we're the only movie podcast.
One of them is This American Life. The other one
is Car Talk.
It's Car Talk. The other one is The Daily with Michael Barbaro, whatever his fucking name is.
One of them is The Adventure Zone.
I'm Michael Barbaro. That's his name. It's Barbaro, right?
Michael Barbaro. I don't know what you're talking about. And then I've never listened to The Daily.
And then Mark Maron and Joe Rogan. And that's all the podcasts that exist. We're the movie one.
Yeah.
The other ones are interview bullshit.
Exactly. We don't interview anybody here. We don't have time for that shit.
No, none of the time for none of that shit. But the movie we're talking about today is Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. The acclaimed children's scary story series.
Pretty acclaimed.
Yeah, pretty acclaimed. Well-liked, beloved, maybe.
Sure.
All of that. Produced by Guillermo del Toro and story by him, right?
Yes, he does have a writing credit. I think it had three writers, but I know he was one of them.
He had like a story by, and then there was like two other writers and then another writer. It was very intense. A lot of people were involved in the making of this movie.
Yes.
And it's directed by Andre
Ovdal.
Ovdal, who directed, he's a Norwegian director, and he did Trollhunter.
Yep.
A Norwegian mockumentary movie about trolls.
Yeah, it's pretty great. I highly recommend watching it. I used to be on Netflix.
Oh, you've seen it?
Oh, yeah. I remember when Troll... I think I first learned about Trollhunter because I love GDT so much. He was talking about Trollhunter and how much he loved it.
GDT.
Guillermo del Toro.
Okay, yeah. That's GDT. A better way of saying his name. Yeah.
Or you just call him G, you know, whatever.
G. Big G. Big Bull.
Big G. Yeah.
Yeah.
Big Toro. But he was talking about Trollhunter. I was like, oh, I should check this out because it's on Netflix. It's great. I haven't seen his second film, The Autopsy of Jane Doe.
Right. Yeah. That's his first like English language movie.
Yeah. I hear it's good, though. Mm. I hear it's a very tightly wound one location horror film.
Yeah. Well, maybe I will have to check that out once I have to figure out if it's on a streaming service or not, because that's my main criteria for watching movies.
Everything's on a streaming service.
Gotta be. It's gotta be. But yeah, that's the movie we're going to be talking about. And here is the box office for this week, the moment you've all been waiting for.
Mm-hmm.
And I, if you were listening last week, you know that I lost my bet and that Fast and Furious Presents Hobbs and Shaw took the number one spot. It beat both Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, Dora the Explorer, and Lion King.
You put a lot of faith into Dora the Explorer.
Honestly, I thought it would be way more popular.
Man, maybe like 15 years ago.
That Hollywood Reporter review probably ruined everything for it.
Yeah. The horniest review.
The horniest review of a movie about a quote-unquote child.
I'm pretty sure that Hollywood Reporter writer is the same guy who wrote the insanely horny review of The Incredibles 2, which is hilarious. I highly recommend everybody go look up that review after this episode.
The Hollywood Reporter review of The Incredibles 2.
Yeah.
That's what we need, some more like film criticism with wild ass takes. Like, hey, the elastic mom from The Incredibles is hot. Real thick.
That's what I want. You know, I want give me a film critic that focuses on every aspect of a film.
Right.
You know,
every single one. What a fucking wild trip. So the point from the box office is that Hobbs and Shaw is still on top. I would say slightly underperformed its second week, but $25 million for a second week is still not bad at all.
How does it compare to the other films in the franchise? I think this is significantly lower.
It is, but also like Hobbs and Shaw is the lowest of, like, it was not as high as regular Fast and Furious movies. So
yeah. So here's the thing. I did not realize that this movie was a $200 million movie, not including marketing.
Right. I mean, I felt like I understood that it was, because it's just like, it's a Fast and Furious movie.
Yeah, but I've seen like other Fast and Furious movies, I think, are cheaper than this. And like, they're like superhero mm-hmm. movies are cheaper than this.
Some are. I mean, I'd say it's like on par.
I don't know, man. $200 million still seems like a lot to me.
What do you think the Fate of the Furious? What do you think the budget was for that?
Fate of the Furious, 160.
No, between $250 and $270 million.
Really?
Yes.
Damn. I feel like that. So this was a budget Fast and Furious.
Right. Yeah, this was budget fucking work, man. I mean, you just have to accept that it's going to make a shit ton of money and throw down the initial budget. And if you don't have to pay those salaries for like every fucking character in the Fast and Furious, you can afford to lose like $50 million. But this is basically the same type of movie, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you tell me, like, you're a bigger fan of these movies than I am.
I guess this just felt a lot more bland. Like, there's nothing that's striking about it compared to the other Fast films, where it's like, there are, at least for the past like five Fast films, there's always been a definitive set piece that looks like, oh yeah, they spent like at least $100 million on this scene alone.
But Furious 7 had a budget of between $190 and $250 million.
Okay.
So this would be on the lower side of that, but it's still like a shit ton of money. It is like comic book movie money.
Yeah. There was a lot of destruction. And I wonder how much The Rock made. Like, The Rock and Jason Statham both have to be decently expensive at this point.
Oh yeah, like multi-million, definitely, yeah, for every movie. I think somebody said like $20 million possibly for Dwayne The Rock Johnson, because he's so fucking famous.
Yeah.
But that seems like so much money for anyone.
Yeah. Well, that's like Robert Downey Jr. got paid $24 million for Infinity War.
He also got paid on points, I think. So for everyone at home, points are when you take money based on the box office performance. So I think that was written into his like Disney contract after Iron Man like 3, maybe, where he's like, "Yo, I'll keep doing this for this amount, but I also want some points."
Yeah, I think you're right. That makes sense. I do remember reading about this.
Yeah, it's I think it's a distinct possibility that Dwayne The Rock Johnson is making a lot of money on Hobbs and Shaw.
There's a chance that Dwayne The Rock Johnson is millions of dollars richer from this movie.
Yes. So, I mean, it's a decent drop off, but it's still doing pretty strong. I'm honestly happy. I feel like Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark coming in at $20 million is
pretty good.
It's pretty good considering the budget. It was only like $25 million. Definitely going to make that money back. I feel like the marketing has been pretty good, pretty highly targeted. I mean, I saw it. It was interesting. I think the Regal By Me is a weird example of who the movie is being marketed to. Because I think I remember when I saw like Widows, which is a movie featuring one of the best black directors like of all time, let alone like one of the best directors of all time, Steve McQueen, led by Viola Davis, a lot of women of color. My movie theater was definitely filled with a lot of people of color, which is interesting because I go to movies there all the time. I see the demographics of people who are in, and it felt like it was like interesting just to like notice that. And then when I saw this movie, I felt like my theater was almost entirely Hispanic.
Really?
So I wonder if they're trying to do this where they're like, oh, we know like Guillermo del Toro is a big Mexican director. He's obviously, he's a big director in general. He's fantastic, but he might have a bigger pull with Hispanic crowds. So they focus the marketing like along demographic lines.
I wonder.
Do you feel like a similar thing in Texas? I know it's like maybe a little bit different in Austin, the demographics. But I know in Chicago, there's a decent spread of all the different types of demographics, especially in like this part of the city.
Yeah, no, I think there's a spread of demographics. One, I think, I mean, I do not know the demographics of the Alamo Drafthouse, which is where I generally see. Yeah, where I generally see most of my movies.
I bet you see a lot of white men there. A
lot of white people, not white men. I think the gender, like the gender balance, is actually I think pretty. It's not even, but it's pretty close. Like closer than a lot of other movie theaters that I've been to.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, the Drafthouse for the most part. When I go, seems pretty white, and that also
I've never seen a lady go to a movie alone, and that might be like interesting. My experience of going to the Regal, and I go alone 90% of the time. I would say to see a movie.
Same.
I see a lot of guys sitting by themselves. I don't think I ever see like girls sitting by themselves.
I have seen girls sitting by themselves. It's definitely more rare, but I've seen it at the Draft House.
Okay, I assume like the Draft House would be a place.
It's just more accommodating, you know. It's less less judgmental,
right? People who are texting are gonna you're getting less of the people who will disobey the social mores,
exactly,
of a movie theater. So, because I feel like if you went to a Regal by me, and you know, women have to put up with a lot more. So going to a theater where there could be like weird guys just hanging around, and there's not a lot of filtering, that could be a major turnoff to going alone.
But yeah,
to the Alamo Draft House, you feel like this is a premium space. There's attentive staff.
Yeah, plenty
who
of
would
staff
definitely
around.
Remove anybody who is even close to being obnoxious.
Yeah. Plus, sometimes you just want to grab some dinner, and you're just
get a burger, some chicken tenders.
Yeah, just get a fucking burger. Be like, yo, I'll watch a movie in the background. Hell, I saw Once Upon a Time in Hollywood this weekend just because I was like, I don't feel like cooking. I'm gonna go to the Draft House, get some dinner. I'm just gonna watch the new Quentin Tarantino movie again.
Yeah,
it was great.
The Alamo Draft House is a like premium movie going experience.
Yeah, I love it. Best part of living in Austin. I know it's in other cities, but it started in Austin. It's still the best in Austin. What was the point of this conversation?
You know, we're talking about movies. We're talking about scary stories to tell in the dark, and I was talking about the differences in demographic marketing, where some of these movies. Have low budgets, but so they highly target their demographics. And just my experience going to the movie theater in that regard.
I wonder if
I don't have the numbers. I don't have their marketing strategy, but it's interesting.
Yeah, it is. It's interesting to see the results of whatever their strategy was. Mm-hmm. But I wonder if I'm sure there was like they definitely tailor their marketing for demographics. I wonder. So this movie has a Mexican lead. One of the leads
Ramon,
is Mexican.
Yeah.
So I wonder if the marketing for that demographic focused more on that character.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe. But I don't know.
I don't know.
Because I'm not part of the, you know, Hispanic Latino demographic. So I was not targeted with those marketing materials.
True. Yeah. Do you find that it would be weird? Because I feel like the Philippines have such a strong connection with Spanish culture. Like at least in Americans' mind, the minds of Americans, do you feel like you have been targeted by advertising focused on Hispanics or Latinos?
Oh, I've definitely gotten Spanish language ads before.
Right,
but
me too.
So that's the thing. I don't know if it's probably just an error on the marketing part, like the marketing side of just like incorrect targeting.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's because I am Filipino, because I don't think that, like, you know, if they were actually trying to target that, then I think they would maybe go for the proper language.
Yeah. Is that a incorrect assessment that is like are Filipinos and like do they speak Spanish in the Philippines at all?
No. Tagalog is the language of the Philippines, and there are different dialects of Tagalog.
So I'm completely off, 1,000,000% off.
Well, no, there is Spanish culture, like, you know, because the Philippines, when they were colonized by Spain. So there's
that's what I'm thinking of then.
Yeah,
gotcha.
There's a lot of Spanish culture in the Philippines. I don't honestly know a whole lot about Mexican culture, so I don't know how similar those two cultures really are.
Uh-huh.
But there is definitely some influence, and Filipinos, I think very similarly to like Mexicans, have a deep like Christianity is pretty deeply rooted in their culture as well because of Spanish colonization.
Specifically.
But yeah, so I don't think I really got targeted by those ads. So I wonder if these ads focused on Ramon and like really just like playing up the fact that this does have a minority lead. So maybe that's why you're seeing those demographics in your theater.
Right. Because I felt like the advertisements that I got for it did not feature Ramon at all.
Same.
I did not even know there was a like Hispanic lead in this movie, which feels weird when you're like, he plays such a big part of the movie and I didn't see any of him in the advertisements. Like, what does that say about the advertising that I was receiving?
Yeah. But also, to be fair, I don't think he was in too many scary situations or any of the super perilous situations he was in that they could have used for the trailers looked like they were part of the third act. And maybe they just didn't want to spoil that.
Maybe. Yeah. I feel like most of the advertising dealt with the Red Spot story.
Yes.
And Harold.
Yeah, Harold for sure. Harold is like, I saw, like, I only ever saw posters for this movie featuring Harold because I think Harold is the most iconic monster from this franchise.
Let's get right into the fucking review of this movie. I feel like we've been circling it for
number three in the box office is Lion King. Whatever, who cares? Moving on to the movie.
Right. Yeah, they all made around $20 million.
Yeah.
And we'll see how that goes.
They're still making millions.
Yeah.
Nothing has changed.
So scary movies to tell in the dark.
Scary stories.
Yes. Did I say scary movies?
You said scary movies.
Scary movies to tell in the dark.
Mommy,
scary stories to tell in the dark.
Tell me a movie.
Yeah. Here's the story of Chinatown, kid. Get ready for a wild fucking ride. Yeah.
Have you ever heard of the Overlook Hotel?
So, Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark is a beloved children's scary movie series, or scary story. I keep saying movies, but it's a scary story collection.
Yes.
A collection of these short horror stories. And I have no experience with these at all. Do you, Rob?
Yeah, I read the first book when I was in like fifth grade or something. It was just one of the books. It was.
What's the structure of it? Like, describe the book in as broad terms as possible.
It's an anthology series. There is no through line to these stories. It's literally just like a collection of urban legends with artwork punctuating each story. And I think the artwork is really why this franchise is so memorable. Because as like, quote unquote, a kid's book, it has some of the most haunting images I've ever seen.
Oh, really? So you think the illustrations are scarier than the narratives?
I think they're more impactful. I don't think they're necessarily scarier because like the images look disturbing on their own. But when you read the context of what the images are seeing the images in context is what really makes them linger. And specifically Harold, because here's a spoiler for the books, but they actually changed Harold's story in this movie. I think they changed a lot of these stories just to make it fit within like the narrative of the movie, because this technically isn't an anthology movie. This is like all of these stories take place in the same universe. There's a through line. There is a conclusion to this story.
Right. They use the narrative device of here are all these teenagers and all these nerdy ones find a book basically that is written by an orphan who is supposedly murdering children and who is hanged for her crimes. But basically this book is evil and it writes these stories, and when it writes them, they become true. And so,
yeah. We don't read the book. The book reads you.
The book reads us. Yeah, exactly. So it's an interesting conceit to the movie that really brings to life scary stories to tell in the dark. How do you make that a movie? You have a book a spooky ass book that writes these stories that include you.
Yeah, I don't think it's clever. I like it. I think it is a
clever device, I think.
It kind of reminds me of I've heard a lot of people call it this, but it does. I think this is a pretty apt description. It feels like the PG-13 version of Goosebumps. The Jack Black movie where he plays R.L. Stine, the author of the Goosebumps books. And then like the story of the Goosebumps movie is that the books he writes come to life. So he keeps them all locked up like in his basement or whatever. So I think that the premise is similar to this, but in this one, you know, the stories actually have menace, you know, like kids die in this movie.
Children are murdered in this fucking,
It's intense. This is definitely not like, I've heard some people call it like Training Wheels horror. I'm like, I think it's a little more than that. Like, you know, Training Wheels horror is like,
I'm trying Monster House.
Monster House, sure. Like the Black Cauldron. Remember that Disney movie?
Maybe. Like Hocus Pocus.
Yes, yeah. Halloween Town.
Right, Halloween. I mean, but that's like real. That's like tricycle horror. I feel like an apt description of this is Training Wheels horror. Like it's not. There's some like disturbing things that happen in it, but nothing is like. It's almost so fantastical that it can't be super scary.
Yeah, I would say that, except for it's the I think it's filmed very viscerally, and I think that I'm trying to imagine what watching this movie as a child would have done to me, because like, so I watched it, like the TV Tim Curry movie, as a child, because my grandpa was watching it. He told me it was a movie about clowns, so I was like, oh, this sounds fun. That fucked me up pretty bad.
Me, a child in love with clowns.
Yeah.
Said no one ever.
I didn't think clowns were threatening until then.
Oh, fuck. Yeah. You had a very innocent childhood.
Yeah.
I knew immediately.
As soon as I saw their face.
Yeah, I'm like, why are they painted?
What are they hiding? Man, if I'd watched this movie as a child, though, I think it would have left a pretty big impact on me. And I think especially the red spot story, the one about spiders coming out of the girl's face.
Yeah.
Seeing that, like I read that as a kid, I was like, oh, that's gross. But like seeing it fully realized was on another level. I'm like, ooh, this is some good body horror.
Yeah, I think the ones that would have gotten me were the Harold story, where he sticks the pitchfork into the guy in the kid's like back, because that always that type of like brutal, like, oh wow, it'd be so easy to like fuck someone up that way.
Yeah,
of taking a pitchfork and like, yep, gotcha, motherfucker. Like you would be so dead, and with like not a lot of effort needing to take place. That always messed me up as a child. And then also the red room, where every hallway he tries to go down, there's this like disgusting blob woman who eventually just like,
what,
like puts him inside of her, I guess.
Yeah, she just absorbs him, which is like,
yeah,
that's always been a terrifying concept to me. Ever since I was a kid, like ever since I think I watched the Blob remake from like the 1980s, I was like, oh, that's fucked up. Just like the idea of like being digested or just absorbed into anything. And especially like the thing too, how it kind of just like assimilates, like, oh, that's gross.
Yeah. The big toe too, just having like you trying to hide from something and it appearing wherever you're hiding. Like, oh God,
that was
like,
just there's, I think
no,
that,
there's no escape.
This movie builds tension really well. I think like all of the sequences are very well directed. I think the biggest weakness with this movie is the writing. I think it feels pretty flimsy at times, and it feels
the
like
child acting. Yeah.
The child acting is not great. The pacing is kind of weird, and how like they interject this kid talking about like, oh, I had a dream. Like they're about to like do something completely unrelated to this kid, and the kid just interjects like, I had a dream last night, and he goes like a 4-minute monologue about what the dream was about, and then they don't cut back, they don't like reference the dream again until, you know, 20-30 minutes after that whole speech is delivered. Like, well, you just had to get that in there because you wanted to set up the set piece.
Yeah, this movie spends about 10 to 15 minutes devoted entirely to building out backstories that we don't care about and are trying to connect these stories. Like, why are people meeting each other in this movie?
Yeah.
Like they all meet Ramon at the very beginning. It's like, why the fuck do we need to know? Like, no, they should all be friends and just build it from there. Like, give us the least, like have this be, what was that show on Nickelodeon with the, like the bonfire?
Scary Stories to Tell No, that's fuck. Are you afraid of the dark?
Are you afraid of the dark? Exactly. It sounds like scary stories to tell in the dark, though.
Yeah,
I know exactly what you're feeling. And but I have it like that, where I'm like, give me just like all these kids who know each other and are friends, and then this bad stuff starts like happening to them. That's what I want. Don't give me all this like meaningless backstory. I don't need a villain. Like, just have bad things happen to like good people. That's all I need.
Yeah.
Cut out like the 15 to 20 minutes building out these disparate arcs and bringing them all into the same thing. Like, have it be four kids who go to this haunted house, find this book, and bad stuff starts happening. Like, that is so easy.
Yeah.
Why complicate it?
And I think you had a tweet about it earlier this week, but you talked about how this could have worked very well as a Stranger Things style television show.
Yes, definitely.
I completely agree, because I do think that they kind of went halfway, where I appreciate that they wanted to make these kids characters and not just like victims, but I don't think it went far enough. So it just feels like time wasted.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And like, give me another 20 minutes, maybe. But then the movie is way too long. Like, I think I might need to go through every character, figure out who they are, what they want, what they hate.
Yeah.
And build that out into like 8 episodes with all these, you know, that we've got Chuck, Ramon, Stella,
Augie.
Ruth, Augie. We got 5 characters that we really care about. I mean, give each one of those like 20 minutes and you got a long time of like a movie without even getting to the scary parts.
Yeah.
Like, every episode could focus on one of these kids and it would have been better.
Yeah.
But since it's so like abbreviated, you feel like you're deprived of knowing more about them so that you can care about them.
Yeah.
But the movie is still demanding that you care about them, even though you don't know anything about them.
I really only cared about Stella because she's the only one that has any real interaction with anybody outside of like the plot mechanics, I guess. Like,
right, yeah.
Dean Norris plays her father in this movie. He gives a great performance.
Heat check. Great heat check. He is the best part about the whole fucking movie.
Yeah, so good. Dean Norris. Shout out to Dean Norris.
Dean Norris plays Hank on Breaking Bad, and he is so good in this movie, and he's literally got like less than 5 minutes of screen time.
Yeah. He made me care about that relationship, and he made me care about Stella as a character when I didn't care about anybody else.
Yeah, this guy shows clearly I care about my daughter. He uses such limited time in the movie to deliver such a powerful like emotional impact.
Yeah.
So he's like, yo, literally, I got like 2 big scenes. I'm really going to throw out for him. And he makes the whole movie better. He grounds it and he establishes an emotional weight that was not there with any of these fucking kids.
Yeah. It's like,
he's so good. Give him a leading role. I tweeted it before and I'll tweet it again.
Please
give Dean Norris a leading role in a blockbuster movie. Tarantino, your last movie, put Dean Norris in it. He can be a fucking star.
Tarantino, cast Dean Norris as the captain of whatever starship is in your Star Trek movie. I will see that in a heartbeat. That sounds amazing.
I would
amazing.
See that so hard. Yeah. Dean Norris. Oh, God.
Yeah. What a guy.
And what a great actor.
So Dean Norris is the moment in this movie that like it really kind of hit me. I'm like, oh, this is like it kind of highlighted why I had such a problem with all of the other kids. Like, all the kids who die in this movie, like, we don't see how any of their family members react ever.
Right.
So they just kind of felt like empty deaths. Like, oh, that's what's supposed to happen in a horror movie. But seeing Dean Norris like plead with his daughter, like, hey, just please come home. Yeah. Please come home. Like, I love you. It's like, it reminded me that like, oh, these are kids just straight up fucking being murdered by this book.
Like, right.
He brings the emotional weight to this story where there previously wasn't. Unfortunately, he does it like, you know, at the start of the third act of the movie, but at least it's something.
Right. And you have that immediate moment of this weird parent-child relationship that is based on like, hey, your mom left but I want you to know it's not your fault, and I love you, and I'll always love you. You have that deep emotional demonstration by a parent to their child.
Yeah.
And that resonated pretty hard with me, at least, harder than anything else. Like,
oh, absolutely.
Usually the gritty kills are enough to make me like, oh, wow, I identify with whoever got that because it sounds like so awful.
Boy, I would hate to be stabbed in the back with a pitchfork.
Like, right. Yeah, I can sympathize with that. But having the father be like, come home, like, I need you here. I wish they had built that out a little bit more. Like, same. I could have taken a few episodes of TV of that, but instead it's abbreviated.
Yeah.
And shout out to Dean Norris again.
Put Dean Norris in the Stranger Things.
Yeah. Honestly, he would be a great...
I think he'd be a fantastic addition.
Yeah. Yeah, he could be like an FBI agent or something.
But I want him to be, I want him... Here's my pitch. Have him be the FBI agent. He comes off as like a bad... Because like, Stranger Things does this with every, like, almost every fucking villain. They come off as an asshole. Yeah. You're supposed to expect them to, like, follow the 80s tropes of, like, oh, secret government agent, he's a bad guy. No, he's a great guy. He's a superhero. He's fucking cool. He's Bob, but he doesn't die.
He shoots bad stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah. God, I was frustrated by how good this movie could have been. Another great part of the movie was the villain design or the monster design.
Yeah, the creature design is great. And like it is Harold. So go look up, like, just look up all of the monsters from this movie to see their renditions here and then their original illustrations from the book. It's uncanny. They did an amazing job adapting these creatures.
Yeah. I mean, like, the special effects department was pulling overtime for this.
Yeah, a lot of practical work.
Yeah, a lot of practical stuff that I thought was really good.
Yeah, very Del Toro.
That's what I love about Del Toro and everything he does is a creation of these weird monsters that are they feel more real because they're practical effects. They're made out of real shit.
They have weight. You can see the actors touching them. They're not having to pretend.
Yeah, I'm like a CGI Harold or a CGI Red Room doesn't work as well as these like carefully created costumes.
And that's actually one of the things that I disliked about this movie is the end. It got very VFX heavy, like with the jangly man.
The jangly man. Yeah.
Like, I think his entrance was great, but he stayed on screen for far too long. And it was very easy to tell just like, oh, he's just an effect. Like, He lost a lot of the menace. I did like how he was introduced with his head falling through the chimney and the cop just being like, are you shitting me? Yeah.
Yeah. What stories do you want to see in the next Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark movie? Dude. Like, what's going on in the sequel that you want to see?
I don't even remember.
Really?
I haven't read these books since like fifth grade.
Yeah.
But I remember the illustrations.
Like, yeah. So are there any ones that are like particularly impactful to you that you remember? Like, besides the ones that are featured in this movie?
Well, so one of the ones that I remember like kind of fucking me up as a kid was, I forget the name of it, but it was essentially like the urban legend about like the passenger on the subway who was dead the whole time.
Okay.
But that's not really like a horror story. That's almost like it's not even really like a Twilight Zone story. It's just kind of morbid,
but it's in the book. Like, what's the story? Is it just,
yeah. So
like, there's this guy,
the story is like, there's this girl who's on a train and she sees these like, It's super late at night. She's on the drunk train and she sees these like two drunk dudes walk onto the train carrying their third drunk friend who's kind of like passed out, and they set him down on the chair like next to her, and they like eventually get up and like walk off the train, leaving her alone next to this guy, and she's just like kind of nervously sitting, not wanting to move or disturb the guy or wake him up or anything. And eventually the train takes like a sharp turn and he just fucking like splats on the ground in front of her, and he his hat falls off and like he rolls up and like she just sees his fucking dead eyes looking up at her. And I remember just being like, oh, that's kind of weird because it's not supernatural. Like, that's just something that's probably happened.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So I wonder if they will go less into the supernatural realm.
I feel like it has to stay in the supernatural realm, though.
Yeah, because the implication that they have in this movie is, hey, these kids die. Like,
yes,
but they can be brought back, maybe.
That's kind of like, what it sounds like. They're like, we don't know where they are. I'm like, it sounds like they're fucking dead. Like,
right. Is the next movie going to be about them saving their friends?
Yeah. I wonder. I don't know how you write the sequel to this movie, because I wonder if it's going to be like Insidious, where like they eventually go to the ghost dimension to like figure out the source of the problem.
Yeah.
Because that's kind of what if they're claiming that their friends are still alive in some alternate dimension, like how do you get them back without visiting it?
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question.
Yeah, so we'll see.
A good question. Yeah, I appreciated this movie for its atmosphere, its creature design, and its camera work. That the photography was good, but other than that, like the plotting and the characters were really, they left a lot to be desired. This is pretty like missable for me. I think people can miss out on this movie.
Yeah, I think genre enthusiasts will enjoy it. And I also think that it's a fun movie if you're a parent. I think this is a horror movie you can watch with your kids. Like, if your kids are at the phase where they're like, I want to see something scary. I think this is a great, like, metric test to see, like, if they're actually ready for real horror, like, depending on how they react to this. And I do think that technically this film is made very competently. I think it's pretty well directed. The effects work is great. You know, we get to see Del Toro's creature team really come to life in this. But yeah, it felt underwritten. But I do like that it's a period piece. I was not expecting that.
Yeah, we never really talked about the whole Nixon thing of it, which I can't place it thematically. It just kind of happening. All right, Nixon's here. There's like a draft. I get it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that to me, at a most basic level, like painting very broad strokes, I think that the draft is, or I think that the book is symbolic of the draft. That like your stories are being written for you and you all die at the end.
Yeah. Yeah. True. Yeah.
I do think that like this film does have like heavier themes than I was expecting, especially since it's an adaptation of like an anthology series in which none of the stories were initially connected.
Right. And it features child murder.
It features child murder. It features draft dodging.
Yeah. The two worst crimes. Yeah.
The worst things you can do as an American.
But yeah, no, I think this is overall skippable. I remember, I think in my review on Letterboxd, I compared it to Crimson Peak, which is a very middle of the road Guillermo del Toro movie.
I still need to see that.
Nah, you don't really need to.
Oh, like, I do.
Tom Hiddleston and Jessica Chastain.
No, like, I'm so visually stimulated, you know, like even if the plot is passable, if the visuals are pleasing to my eyes and it generates like a reaction to me where I'm like, oh, this is beautiful. I think it's a movie worth watching.
OK, yeah, then maybe because the art direction of that movie is amazing. The costumes.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Like, I love Speed Racer.
Still have never seen it.
Oh, we can remedy that.
Yeah, that's it's definitely on my list. I think it'd be a very fun movie to watch.
Yeah,
what a wild ride.
Yeah,
love Susan Sarandon.
Yeah, totally. She's great. I love that's the reason I love Speed Racers, because of Susan Sarandon's performance.
Right. Yeah. No, it's all about the cars. Yeah.
You gotta know what it wants.
I have no idea what that means. So overall, I would say, you don't need to see this movie. This will be on Netflix. Like, this should have been a Netflix original movie.
Yeah, but I do think, okay, so horror movies to me always,
that's the level.
They always benefit from a theater experience.
True.
I love the, like, horror movies I think should always be seen in the theater. Very, like, isolated. It's massive in front of you. There's nowhere else you can really look unless you close your eyes.
Uh-huh.
But I think, I agree, this movie's worth seeing if you have kids that want to see something kind of spooky. But I wouldn't see it unless you have, like, a Regal subscription or a Cinemark or AMC subscription or something at this point.
Right. I paid 57 cents to see this movie.
Yeah. Did you really?
And that, yeah. Because wow. It's like, yeah, the whole Regal thing, like, if you have the unlimited to buy your tickets in advance, it's only like 50 cents.
Ooh.
It's great. Yeah.
Okay. Regal, sponsor us.
Yeah, please sponsor us. We will get you subscriptions.
At least 37. We can promise
at
that.
At least 37. That's a lot of money. That's thousands of dollars. Yeah. Well, all right. I think we're done with this. We don't really know what we're going to do next week because there's not a lot of movies coming out. We might do a special episode. Not sure.
Yeah,
but y'all should stay tuned.
Yeah, stay tuned. It's a surprise. It's like a loot box, you know? You don't really know what you're going to get when you hit play on next week's episode.
Right, but one day it will be regulated by the government. So
the Belgian government.
Yeah, it'll be complicated. But don't worry about it. You don't have to worry about it now, like right now. You don't have to worry about it tomorrow.
Yeah.
Everything will be fine.
Worry about it next week.
Yeah.
Get nervous.
But so, yeah, exactly. There will be an episode, mark my words, next week. It might be crazy. It might be fun. Probably our best episode ever, I think.
Yeah, I think that's a fair claim.
Yeah. So all you nuts out there better tune in because we're really going to kick it up a notch.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. But for now, you know about me. I'm Dan Leo. Follow me at The Dan Leo Show. Follow the podcast at Viewing Angles.
Podcast.com. There you go.
Yeah.
Pause for dramatic effect.
Right. Pause for dramatic effect. And the Twitter is at Viewing Angles. And Rob, who are you? Who are you on the internet?
I am Robert Jr. Jr. And you can use that handle to follow me on Twitter and Instagram and Letterboxd.
Hell yeah. All right. Well, until next week, nuts, it's been us.